From multiple depicted locations in Minneapolis or near enough, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are games and other media and online play. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Hello! I don't know why I'm saying hello, but hi!
Hey, Steven.
How's it going?
Welcome to the podcast, Steven.
It's pretty good. How are you?
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Mark, you were on a PAX panel recently, yes?
I was on a PAX panel recently. PAX was a 9-day online event across 3 Twitch channels this year. And I was part of a panel called Lovely or Lethal? Will These Animals Cuddle Me or Kill Me? It was a very provocative title. And it was just about animals in video games, how they're depicted, sort of narratively, mechanically. This panel took the form of little mini talks. So each of us who was part of the panel prepared 10 minutes and pre-recorded them, stitched them together in a little sort of anthology talk, which is a really cool format. The talk featured some previous guests on this show, and each had a little interesting thing to say at a totally different angle from their different backgrounds. And I talked a little bit about Widget Satchel and our approach to bringing a ferret main character into a game. And the big sort of like angle I had on it was this notion of how Sprocket is a pet ferret, not a Sonic the Hedgehog, right? So like Sonic the Hedgehog is like too cool to be anyone. Like it's just a human in an animal costume. And a lot of video game animals are like that. And then sometimes video game animals are like animal simulators. So even though they're not realistic, a game like Untitled Goose Game or Goat Simulator are actual like simulation games. You're meant to be that animal. Even though it's an imagined crazy experience. But with Sprocket's neither of those things. Sprocket was somebody's pet. And so the player's motivations in getting Sprocket to the shuttle bay is different from Sprocket's motivations to get to the shuttle bay. And so I talked a little bit about how that works and how I think we can do a lot more with that idea in games and how we expressed it with an animal. So that was a really fun thing. So that's just a mini little version of my 10-minute piece of a hour-long PAX panel, and it's on YouTube now, because by the time you hear this episode, the PAX has been over for a bit now. We'll put the link in the show notes so you can check that out as well and see the whole talk and see all the other stuff that happened at PAX, because this year's PAX had like tons and tons of stuff compared to a normal PAX, because it was easier to get people from all over the world. And so it was just 9 days, 24 hours on 3 Twitch channels, just tons of content. By that token is how I was able to squeeze in there and give a talk. We just had a whole episode on imposter syndrome, but that's me expressing it, is I don't know that I'd be able to get on a PAX panel if it wasn't in these unusual circumstances, which is something else that we want to talk about, right?
Yeah. The pandemic is still happening.
Is
it still
just,
sucks.
Is it just our check-in?
Yeah. Yeah. How's that going? That's why I said hello.
Yeah.
I don't know how y'all are doing. Well, because it's like we used to record these episodes in person, right?
Yeah.
And we're not doing that anymore.
It's weird because the last time we recorded in person was just before Ellen joined us.
Yeah.
And so basically we sort of promised you this amazing experience of hanging out with us, getting lunch on our recording times and talking face to face with interesting folks who are around the table with us. And nope, that's not how we do the show now.
That's not how we do the show now.
Yeah.
I mean, I did have the chance to experience the full Nice Games Club, you know, guest host.
Yes.
Shebang.
Yeah.
Long before.
Longtime listeners know that Ellen joined us long before she joined us.
Yes.
Yes. I was a guest sometimes. And you guys did buy me food and it was awesome. But now I have a Sunday tradition of getting myself junk food on the way over.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's talk about that. Steven and I are recording from our homes, but you have a little hideaway that you're able to record from. That's a little bit more, have fewer dogs than where you normally are.
Yeah. I am able to go into the office, which is feeling more and more alien each time I do it. Not because it's changing, just because it's been so long since I've done any work from here.
Right.
So just grab a conference room and set up a laptop and a mic and do the recording from here. That way my dogs can bark and I don't have to be mad at them. And my husband can play trumpet and I don't have to be mad at him. It works so much better this way.
Yeah.
So we'll see. And I hope, you know, everything's so up in the air right now because of the stupid pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully this arrangement is able to stick until we're able to record in person again.
Yeah. We'll see. Is it weird to be in your office only when nobody else is there and to not do your day job at your office?
It was, but now for like since March, basically, this is the only reason I've come into the office is to record Nice Games Club. So now it'd be weird to like do, I think there were a couple days in there where I tried coming in and working at my standing desk because the company policy right now is if you want to come in, you can, but no one wants to,
right?
Because there's only certain benefits, the benefits of being in person to do work aren't there unless your whole team is there.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if the whole team is there, then no one's there. And that means no one's here.
Right.
Oh man. I miss my office so much.
Yeah. You've talked about this on the shows before, Stephen, but it's been a little while since we've checked in on your feelings of it. Is it any better, any worse?
I don't think that it's worse. I just think that it hasn't improved at all. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm trying to be more willing to go outside of my apartment.
Yeah.
Because I think I've been like paranoid from leaving my apartment for a while. So like I've been attempting to leave more frequently. Yeah.
You mean like taking walks safely, or?
Yeah, I like taking walks and stuff. Mm-hmm. I would like to do more social things because I'm realizing more and more that like part of me is social and needs in-person interaction more frequently. And like us playing online and stuff has been great, but it doesn't scratch all the
itch. Yeah, it doesn't fill all the gap there.
So
yeah, long-time listeners know we did start doing this before the pandemic. We were playing, we play games together on the weekends. Us here in the clubhouse and then other friends of ours. And yeah, that has been like, it's always tough to get friends again for a weekly thing. Anyone who runs a D&D game knows this, but now it's a little easier because everyone's anxious to have these spaces and these times. And and setting them up ad hoc is actually quite difficult. Having a regular setup is usually a lot more. So, Stephen, you're looking for more opportunities during the week for these kinds of things.
Well, or just like safe ways where I can interact with people, like in person.
Yeah, obviously.
In person thing that I'm missing a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me too.
Like people hanging out at the end of the driveway or whatever. Some people have been doing.
Yeah.
The people they've come up with strategies for stuff like this. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I live by myself, so I've been isolating myself a lot. And, the reason I say that is because like, I haven't looked into what is safe. Like I've just heard from people that these are good, these are bad, but I need to do this myself. So I'm going to be looking into that some. And
then I mean,
be safe about it.
But, you know, off mic, Stephen, you know my view is I think that people are taking too many chances. But and ultimately, everyone does need to decide for themselves. But the frustrating thing for listeners who are also having this kind of struggle of like, how do I be safe? Is the truth is none of us know. And the sad, the disappointing thing is that we don't have a lot of authority to look to tell us what's safe. In the early days, we needed instructions. We needed, do this. This is what you need to do that we all needed to blindly follow. And we didn't get that, right? And people know why. And now we need guidelines. We need, this is what makes sense. And the thing was what was supposed to happen between the instructions and the guidelines was research, was social scientists, was people in government, people who could then come up with these things. Like, well, now, I mean, we started this thing off where everyone's like, don't touch a doorknob. Right. It's you don't need a masks are not important or not as important. Washing your hands for 20 seconds is important. But we know a little more now. We know that it's actually the masks are more important and you should still be washing your hands and you should still be like, you know, avoiding contact with unfamiliar spaces. But that's not as much of the threat as it was once seen. And don't take me as any guideline onto what that means. But we need people to tell us how to interpret that information. And what's happening is we're all doing it for ourselves. And then folklore emerges where people just generally, because they've a couple people figured it out or think they figured out something and they told their friends and they told their friends. And because this is a numbers game, you could be very irresponsible and it's quite likely you'll never get COVID. Right. But that's not the point. Right. The point is that you're rolling the dice every time. And so the question is like when about kids going back to school. when is it, if we're going to roll the dice, let's roll it as few times as possible. Let's make sure we do it for important reasons. And some, maybe those important reasons are the fact that you're going to go stir crazy. Like that's, but, and it's really hard for a, make a personal judgment, but that's all we've been given to do. So Stephen, like you were saying that, that, you know, you don't know what's safe, and what you hear is safe is folklore. And that's,
that's why I want to look into it myself. Like I don't want to like just assume just because somebody is like, oh yeah, you can go to bars, it's safe. I don't know that for sure. I need to make that, I need to learn information and then make a judgment call for myself. And it, like, no matter what I do, it's going to be some form of a risk. I just need to accept those risks.
Right, right. And ultimately,
if I make that decision.
Yeah. And ultimately, it's an, it's an incredible burden on you to have to do that research yourself, because you're not equipped for it. And the research, and I don't mean you in particular. I mean, you as an individual actor are not. And it's just not fair. It's not fair that you have to do that. But you're right. That's the only, it's the only thing you can do now. We've talked about pandemics that I, for listeners who are maybe bored of this topic or frustrated by this topic, it's important we address it from time to time. But I feel very strongly that, like, it's very easy for us to lose or forget the fact that we are all, that the sort of collective spirit that we had in March and April as we were trying to figure out how to make this work, we're all suffering now. And the, the truth of it is a lot of us are trying to find ways to get around the suffering. But like, my feeling is that we have to continue suffering. Like that's, that is the price we need to pay. But I don't know. I don't have the guidelines as to what's safe. Like I'm being fairly, you know, I have immunodeficiency issues. So like I have particular motivation to be a little bit more cautious. But I don't know that that's right. When it comes to people's mental health, like it, where's that balance? Like it's, and so I'm not, I don't have any answers, but it, it does. When I do hear people talk about like, oh, you know, I quarantined myself for, or I didn't go outside for a couple of days. So now I'm going to go camping with friends or whatever. And like, they didn't talk to anyone for a couple of days. I'm like, okay, I guess, but like, that still feels really scary to me. And I don't know. I don't know. It's very disappointing because we did need that. We needed trusted authorities to be able to tell us first what to do and then, you know, how to make the choices for ourselves, so that we would feel responsible. And I don't think we're getting that from anyone. And that's really disappointing.
Well, how, I'm checking in with you, Mark. How have you been?
Well, we talked before about how like I'm a work from home person, so I've done okay by that score. And that's keeping on. The thing that's actually been getting me is that I've like physically, like I used to go out in the sense that I would, I used to ride my bike a lot and I would, I'd go out on errands and for food. And I'm really very much more, in a way that I don't really appreciate or understand as much. My life is quite a bit more different than I think it is kind of what I'm getting at. And so like I have, you know, I have more physical pains, like my diabetes, I have to manage that. And when I'm outside the line on managing that, which is sort of a constant everyday thing, I have physical problems, and those are a little bit more acute now. And they happen slightly more frequently. And so that's the, I mean, I just went on about how like we have to accept the suffering. And so that's kind of what I've done. And so part of me is a little bit like upset that, cause it's very clear to me like, that, because there's not much I can do about it. Like a solution to it would be just to go back to my old routine. And there isn't really any other solution to it. But I do need to, Stephen, like you, I need to get out a little bit more. I need to take my bike out for no reason, which is hard for me. I need to have a reason.
I know, me too.
I need to come up with new habits. And so that I haven't done enough of that work because it was, it's not difficult for me to stay at home or I didn't think it was. So that's the, that's what's getting me down right now.
Sure.
Yeah.
I felt that some too, because I haven't, like I said, I haven't been as physically active as I had in the past. Yeah. I used to walk a decent amount. Well, not decent, but like I would walk some and take the train and stuff to get to work and things. So.
Yeah.
Just don't do that as much.
I've heard people talk about how like they've taken up exercise routines and they have, they've still gained weight. Like,
I've been working out with Dale.
That's fun. Yeah. That she really enjoys that.
I like that too.
Yeah. But it's interesting because like we, the line from A to B isn't so obvious. Like, cause we, I don't think any of us know how much things have changed for us. We're human beings, so we naturally adapt, but we're not keeping track of it all. And so it is, I do see it on Twitter a lot. People say like, I really took this time to myself to really get in shape. And how am I 10 pounds more? Like, it's like, well, because other things changed, right? It wasn't that you just started an exercise routine. You know? we don't have, there's no way to put a button on this topic. It's ongoing.
Right.
But hopefully this gives listeners who have been feeling their own individual experiences some context as to how we're handling it.
Yeah.
And we'll check in again at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Because this isn't going to end soon, sadly.
Yeah. Right.
I'm going to put air quotes around my handling it.
Yeah. Okay, positive news. Let's go.
Yeah.
Hype stuff. Fun things. Ellen, what's the next topic?
You know, we picked these topics ahead of time, and I brought this one up because I just thought there was going to be so much to talk about. And then the topic was games and other media. So, like, how are games depicted in literature and movies, and what's like, how does this intersect with these different types of media and these different art forms? And I realized we are not a critic. We're not a critiquing podcast. We're not a games criticism podcast. We are a games development podcast. So I had to kind of spin it a little bit and try to, you know, bring it back to, well, what does that mean for game developers? And, you know, is that something worth exploring? And I thought, yeah, it was still worth exploring because I think that, you know, as we'll talk about it, there's a lot of examples of kind of media that's drawing from games and media that's depicting games and games that's bringing other things. You know, these things are blending and they will continue to blend because that's just the nature of art.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, you know, it might be good to start with a few examples of what we've experienced in recent times. And then maybe talk a little bit about what the implications are for developers and where things might be headed next.
Yeah.
So, with that, I wanted to start by just kind of listing out just a bunch of examples and kind of talking a little bit about what we remember about games being depicted in different forms of entertainment and art.
Yeah.
So starting with literature, like I think one of the ones that just popped to my mind immediately was Quidditch.
Right.
Right. And okay, it's not a video game. There are Harry Potter video games, and that's another interesting facet to this conversation is that like books get made into video games, but sometimes those books also depict games that are then made into games, and Quidditch is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. There's like there's a whole college intramural league, right?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. I planted my flag in this topic. Like,
it's super silly, but you know what? Yeah. If you broke it down and described like any other field sport.
Yeah.
With just the mechanics, uh-huh. It would totally sound silly as well. Maybe not quite as silly as they have a broom.
Yeah.
And they're running with the broom.
That's the part that gets me is like, you could, by the real world rules of Quidditch, like, they don't require the broom. That's just a hazard. It's just a stick they're waving around. Someone's going to lose an eye.
They want to be wizards though, Mark.
Yeah. I wonder, not to bring it back down again, but I wonder if recent news has made it less exciting to want to be a wizard in the wizarding world of Harry Potter.
Oh, I suppose.
Yeah. I'm assuming we were talking about J.K. Rowling being...
Yes, the transphobic comments. And it's like...
Yeah.
It's a sad thing for people who love that franchise because they have to come to terms with what it means to them to continue to be fans. And I suppose that's true for people who are super into Quidditch as a real thing because it's a real thing now. Mm-hmm.
At the U, like they had a Quidditch. I think it was a club. I don't think it was literally like they.
The NCAA is not putting up money for it yet. But
yeah, are there other examples like that?
Yeah, there actually are quite a few. So, also in authors that disappoint me, Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game.
Oh,
okay, sure.
Which is interesting because it is Ender's Game. Personally, I'd classify it more as Ender's Simulation, but it, you know, the entire, if you haven't read the book, it's a great book.
Mm-hmm.
Not a, that author is
it? Yeah. It's a whole category of literature now, isn't it?
But there are like lots of them, right? So, and I think you'll find a lot of these in fantasy or sci-fi,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So these games are written into the stories to kind of set up the like in Ender's Game to set up the dynamics of the plot overall, and then also I think to kind of convey the level of skill or the type of mind that some of the main characters have, and that's true for Ender's Game. That's true for Harry Potter. There's also if you are familiar with Brent Weeks, the fantasy series, his Lightbringer series has a really easy detailed description of a card game that he kind of invented. It's like sort of poker, sort of bridge, sort of tarot called Nine Kings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that he uses it, is like as a means for two characters to interact and develop and get insight into their inner workings through the way that they play the game.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
There's been literature that's used chess for that purpose, where chess becomes mm-hmm. part of the setting of a piece of fiction in order to reveal things about characters. But in a fantasy mm-hmm. or science fiction universe, you'd want to have something, develop something unique, but that gives you the opportunity to develop something specifically geared towards the story you want to tell, right?
Right, right. You mentioned chess. I'm thinking of that one West Wing episode where President Bartlett's like playing five or six games of chess with different people all over the West Wing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got them all in his head. Mm-hmm. And it was a cool way of showing, because you know, if you're familiar enough with the mechanics of chess, you know that that's crazy hard to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so having this character do it and like not and do it almost effortlessly was a real way of kind of, I think, underscoring how intelligent that character was.
Yeah. Let's remember to put that episode in the show notes, because it is a really great example of using games in a really effective dramatic purposes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Hey, Mark here, cutting in from the Nice Games Clubhouse edit suite to do you one better from what I promised just a moment ago. Because it's so interesting, the episode that Ellen brought up from the West Wing is called Hartsford Landing. It's a season 3 episode, and it is the episode that the West Wing cast has reunited to perform a stage reading of this fall, which is going to be, I think they already did the recording, and it's going to be put on HBO Max, I think it is, and it's also meant to be a get-out-the-vote drive for the election coming up, which I heartily endorse the aims of. So we'll put that in the show notes as well, so you can take a look at not just the episode that we're referring to that's really relevant to this topic, but also something that happens to be really timely at the moment. So interesting aligning of the stars there. All right, back to the show.
Yeah, so there are just so many, like Ready Player One, Oasis, the VR game.
Mm-hmm.
That's a, you know, was recently made into a movie, which is what I'm going to move on to next. Jumanji is another one. It was a book.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
A simple book about a game that then got made into a movie, and probably they made the game, which is kind of where I wanted to move into this, as, you know, before we bring it back to game development, is just kind of what we're seeing is like these very, it's like cross media franchises that either start or have a game involved. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Ender's Game was made into a movie. You know, the Harry Potter books were made into games, but then also Quidditch itself, which was a game from the books, was made into a real game.
Mm-hmm.
Ready Player One was made into a movie. Jumanji was made into a movie. And then there's this flip side where there are games that then have like comics and movies made about them. So like Warcraft, Halo, Final Fantasy, there are graphic novels and comics and actual novels, and then also movies. So that's interesting how that has kind of, there's like lots of cross-pollination happening in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very true.
Isn't it like there's always a conversation about like Asteroids got optioned or something, and and you always want to it's always like little winks to an audience, like a game that's made into a movie isn't always it's almost never about that game, but then there's always these little hints at like gameplay mechanics. It's kind of winks to the audience, and they elicit either like, you know, knowing winks or like some groans in the audience. But like, that's interesting that like, really what those movies are taking is the setting. They're not really taking the game. It's much the stuff around it. But then sometimes they try to lean into what the gameplay elements in a way.
What I would like to see from like video game movies is like they take the essence of the game and put it in a movie form. I mean, that's easier said than done, because like video games they create different experiences than movies can, just by nature of, you know, the interactivity.
Mm-hmm.
One movie I really like that's a video game movie is Prince of Persia: The Sands of Time.
Yeah,
a lot of people didn't like that movie, but it's just a real fun adventure movie. Just going on an adventure with Jake Gyllenhaal and all the other people who are in that movie.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time, but I should watch it again.
Yeah. And that movie is a pretty good, if you don't know that's from a game, You'd just be like, this is an interesting fantasy movie. It's one of those things like, not a lot of people love it, but almost nobody hates it. Like, it's a solid movie. But also it's based on that PlayStation 2 series of games that had lots of time travel mechanics, and that's in the movie. And as it forms a big part of it in a way that feels a little gamey, but not in a way that's like winking to the audience. So that might be the best example.
Yeah. And then I'm also reminded of, this might be beyond the scope of the topic, but I'm reminded of games that have like, or movies that have like game mechanics in them, but aren't based off of any games.
Yeah.
So there's that one, what's the name of that one movie? It's got Tom Cruise in it and Emily Blunt.
Oh,
like Tom Cruise dies.
Yeah, no one knows the title of it because they kept changing it. Edge of Tomorrow.
Was changed to Live, Die, Repeat or something.
Yeah. Well, I think the original was called like something like that.
It's based on a graphic novel called All You Need Is Kill, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's what it is. Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like the whole, it's very confusing. But what's interesting about that is it uses the idea that you as the player, main character or whatever, can like try something, fail, and then try it again.
Right. Yeah. And you know more about the world, you know, the patterns of the guards and and that's on full display. And that's a movie that only works after a generation of people grew up playing video games.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Matrix being able to just instantly acquire a new skill.
Yeah.
The way that you do in a game. I mean, like you gain access to a new ability and then you have to practice with it. But it's the same thing that happens in the Matrix. Like, I know Kung Fu. It's like, well, show me.
Yeah.
Yes, you've unlocked the ability, Neo, but can you actually use it?
Yeah.
Well, compare that to a movie like Groundhog Day, which has similar like magic things. That does not have video game language in it at all, though it's sort of similar to Live, Repeat or whatever that movie's called. But it uses a different kind of lens for that kind of thing, even though Bill Murray's character does, you know, learn new skills and knows where people are going and all the same things from other time loop movies. But it's framed much less in the language of games, the way that more recent ones have been, because there's more of that literacy is available in culture.
Yeah,
but like, I guess it's like kind of a different topic, because it's like movies using video games as opposed to.
Ellen's topic is broad enough to encompass this, I imagine. Wouldn't you say, Ellen?
I think so. And I did want to touch on that because I think, I mean, like Mark was just saying, and I'm glad that you brought this up, Mark, because I think that's the underlying kind of thread through all of these different experiences in these that are classified as different media, even though they're they seem like more and more blended the more you look at them, is that games literacy is more, it's broader than it ever has been in terms of who's got it, right? Like, more people play video games now than ever have. Yeah. And that means that the language of games and the actions of games and mechanics are familiar to more people than ever before, and it can be used in different ways. But it's not just like, you know, referencing a joke or a character. You have to reference an experience, a structure, and a feeling. And I think that makes it like a different thing to kind of like reference and copy and move. Then, you know, like being able to reference like a place or a character or like a joke from, you know, from The Office or something like that. It's harder to move like game mechanics from one medium to the other. But it's interesting. It's really interesting when it happens. So I'm curious to see, like, you know, as we talk more about examples, what, you know, if there are any emerging trends that we might uncover. To that end, I wanted to kind of take another look at this overall topic, which is games depicted in cinema and TV as an element of the story. So we talked about like how games can be depicted in literature as an element of the story and what's the purpose they serve there. We talked a little bit about, like, you know, the episode of The West Wing, good example. Right. But a couple, I think three TV shows that are very, very, that use this a lot are, or relatively often, Star Trek. And Star Wars is, you know, now it's more, there are more TV shows and things like that. But then also Black Mirror.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So Star Trek has like this long history of showing games as like a part of the culture of the century and like the time that it's in, but also different games for different alien cultures that they encounter and things like that. Mm-hmm. And Black Mirror, I think, uses games in a similar way where it depicts in a couple different episodes, like Playtest, 15 Million Merits was another one. That was the Viking one.
Mm-hmm.
They are using games as a, you know, way of looking at that particular aspect of the culture. So yeah. I thought that was really interesting that those seem to have kind of using games for the same purpose.
Yeah, yeah. I have a bunch of Star Trek examples that can illustrate that point very well. If we have a couple of hours to go through them.
Why don't you
have a couple of hours to go through Star Trek?
Okay, so there's two examples I really like, and yeah, okay. I'll throw in a third one. But so people, 3D chess, there's this particular, the idea of 3D chess is like, you've seen that in a lot of places, but there's no official 3D chess game. In Star Trek, there's a particular shaped board that's called 3D chess. It has no rules. People have developed rules for it, but there's no canonical rules for them. But in the very first episode of Star Trek, at least the first aired episode of Star Trek, you see Spock playing a 3D chessboard. There was also 3D checkers, I believe, in that same scene, but they didn't use that prop after that. So it's part of the history of Star Trek, the idea that you had these, and it's important to Star Trek to have these things that feel part of an evolving world. So a lot of times, and Star Trek does this too, there's like Hoverball is a thing that exists and you have no idea what that is, right? And there's these like made up games that you just imagine are part of this unseen culture. And that's true in lots of science fiction. But 3D chess is a really good one because it's this idea. And in fact, I don't think anyone even calls it 3D chess. Just that's what we call it as fans of Star Trek. I don't know that it has a specific name. But it says the idea that like this thing that was from the past gets taken to the future. And not just that, but Vulcans play it because we are all together part of the United Federation of Planets. So, of course, a game from Earth would make its way to Vulcan. And somehow it got adapted, and who knows who made it 3D or came up with those rules. But like, it just becomes part of this thing that's a continuity of history, which a lot of science fiction doesn't always appreciate. And so I love that use of gameplay in there. The other really good example that I quite like that's very core to an episode is there's a season 2 episode of The Next Generation called Peak Performance, and it's about a war games scenario. Apart from that, there's a side story about the strategic consultant that they bring on to conduct these war games is supposedly a master of a game called Stratagema. And it's just like, he's the best there is. And the culture he's from is particularly good at this game. And, but it's a game that's played on many planets. And there's they go to Data and they say, Data, you're a super powerful computer. And like, you should challenge him to a game of Stratagema because, he's a little bit he's got his chest puffed and he's a little bit of a blowhard. Let's bring him down a notch. And so Data plays him and loses and he doesn't understand like, how did I lose? And there's this like this great line from this episode that Picard tells him. He says, it is possible to make no mistakes and still lose. And it's a game that taught him that, which is so interesting because it's the simplest expression of a concept like that. And then at the end of the episode, he challenges to a rematch. But in this one, they go toe to toe. It's a dramatic. It goes on and on and on. It's a stalemate forever. And then eventually, the expert player just gets frustrated and quits. And everyone says like, Data, you beat him. And he goes, I didn't technically beat him. And his goal was not to win. His goal was to extend a stalemate because he's an android and he could do it forever. And so. So it also shows like how like different play styles and how you approach a problem and how you can take the simple simulated scenarios of a game and you can learn life lessons from them. And so it's a great episode of Star Trek that uses the language of games. And of course, Stratagema itself is this hilarious looking video game thing with like little props on everybody's fingers and it makes clickety clack sounds. It's not so ridiculous that you can't take the story seriously, but it's kind of funny. So that's a really good one. But there's lots of games in Star Trek have served that purpose. There's a Cardassian board game that is in an episode where a Cardassian character gets sort of he gets sort of infected and becomes kind of ruthless. This is Garak from Deep Space Nine, and he ends up kind of menacing another one of the characters in this sort of cat and mouse scenario. And they're talking over comms, and he's explaining this board game Katra to him, and he's like, I would love to play against you. You have a keen strategic mind. And it shows him sort of maintaining his intellect, but going emotionally crazy. And yeah. and him still understanding and appreciating this like very strategic technical concept is a way to communicate to the audience that he's not, that he still has his wits about him, and that makes him more scared, more frightening. And it uses an example of a game to distill that. Star Trek's loaded with stuff like this. It's really, really effective because it's a good storytelling technique. Those are my three examples, Stephen. I've eaten up all the time. I promise.
Yeah. Yep. We're cutting you off.
I'm gonna have to throw away these pages of notes I've prepared, but whatever.
Well, you can maybe put them in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a list of games in Star Trek on Memory Alpha. We'll put that in the show notes.
There is. Yeah. There's actually extra. There's a Wikipedia article on it too.
Oh, really? It's made it to Wikipedia?
Yeah. I think it's made it to Wikipedia. Of course it has. Yeah, so there's a lot on there. It's kind of cool. And I want to come back to that because there's interesting opportunities, I think, for game development in the works on all that. But last couple things I wanted to mention was just like there are now some more other types of media. And this is not new, but I think it may be starting to get new in terms of the reach and the size of platform that it's getting to. And that is other types of media pulling in technical capabilities of games to play with the experience. So like Netflix made that movie thing called Bandersnatch.
Isn't that a Black Mirror episode?
It is. It is a Black Mirror episode.
I mean, it has to be because it's pretty bad if you want to call it a video game.
That's fair.
It's bad if you want to call it a video game. Yeah. And I think that's fair. I think it's still an episode. Mm-hmm. I personally didn't think it was that compelling. I think they maybe like it just felt like they were felt like it just felt too clever, like, oh, look at this cool thing we're doing. It's like you're not doing anything I haven't already experienced for several hundred hours. It's just on my TV.
In my opinion, it reflected a complete misunderstanding of what video games are.
Yeah.
And so I have a very low opinion of that.
Yeah. But I am curious, just because they missed the mark doesn't mean that the opportunity to play in that space isn't there.
Right.
But I agree with you that I think they missed the mark as to what would make a compelling interactive experience.
There is a better example, though.
Okay, tell me.
Which is uses the exact same technology on Netflix. It plays the same way. It's the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt movie plays out as an interactive story. And it is... It works exactly the same as Bandersnatch. It has all the same tricks. It has just about as many interactive choices. It's basically a reskinned version of that game. And it's, other than it just being an enjoyable, but apart from it being an enjoyable episode, if you like that series, it's a very successful expression of that form because of the way that the story handles those moments. So if you played Bandersnatch, you're like, this is innovative, but I don't like it. Like you just, because that's kind of what a lot of people thought, because you just couldn't, you just had to accept that it was new. But if you want to see it done well, Unbreakable, it's Kimmy versus the Reverend is the name of it. You can find that on Netflix.
That's the thing, though, is that like it's not innovative. It's just a visual novel.
Yeah, it is pretty much. Yeah.
I mean,
a really high budget one.
Yep.
To be fair, I think visual novels in general are not
careful.
AAA developers, generally speaking, aren't making visual novels.
Right.
So. A lot of people haven't heard of visual novels. And so like it being on the Netflix service, I think makes it a more, it makes it more novel as a result, just because like it's a more accessible version, I guess.
Yeah. The technology is not any more interesting than your standard visual novel, but I will say, and it isn't just because it's made by Hollywood producers, but it does, it is a different experience. It is not in any way technically more innovative. Like
sure.
It's in fact quite a bit more rudimentary than your average indie visual novel is. But there is, but it does have it is a different experience by way of it being an interactive movie versus what visual novels are usually prose. And that is different, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
There are a couple of Star Trek examples that were produced in the 90s of
you got
of
three.
You got your three. Use your budget.
All right.
You just put that in the show notes, Mark.
Okay, show notes.
I'm reminded of like the something that like we maybe haven't talked about is like a lot of games have visual and audio and physical feedback. Like, you know, rumble on your controllers and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that theaters were experimenting with that some. Like there are some fancy seats that you can get mm-hmm. where like they have like speakers in behind your head that
right.
like mm-hmm. will
or the seats
shake.
Would rumble or whatever.
Yeah, the seats would rumble and
theme
stuff.
Park stuff.
And I'm reminded of there's an old horror movie that I remember hearing about where like they had I can't remember what it's called. I'm gonna have to look this up. But like they had I think like they had equipped all of these seats with like feeler things, and like the main villain, the evil Ugh. Monster or whatever, was a centipede. So I think what would happen is as you're watching the movie, the like some of the seats would randomly like have the little crawly thingy behind you, so you would like feel it in it. Yeah, it made for a real creepy experience, I think, for people.
Nope.
I'm gonna have to find that and see if I can find that. But like, yeah,
the gold. Nope. you know, you mentioned theaters, and you're referring to movie theaters, but yes. You actually reminded me of something that I didn't even think to put in this list, which is live theater. And
yeah,
I know there's when we don't have a pandemic on, Minnesota has an amazing Fringe Festival, and mm-hmm. if you're not familiar with Fringe Festivals, you should definitely look it up because it's a really cool way of getting like innovative artists to be able to create, you know, their own stage plays, and they get produced and they get put on, and like there's this whole thing. And Minnesota's got a great one because I think it's totally lottery based, like totally wacky stuff gets on there, and it's always really cool to go experience it because I'd say, you know, most of it's cool to watch. Yeah. And I think there have been some plays that like really leaned on audience participation in a mm-hmm. way that was game-like, right? Because audience participation in theater is not new. It's
yeah.
part of theater. Mm-hmm. But the way that they had structured it was very game-like. And mm-hmm. so it's another example of kind of this blending of media.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a weird idea, but what about like stand-up comics? And like how they will often feed off of the energy of the audience, you know, to make their jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Or will ask for like they'll ask the audience where you're from, and then they'll make fun of that place or something.
Yeah.
That's I mean, it is a bit interactive, right? The audience has an opportunity to interact with the
there audience. Is I think to fully realize that in the same way like a visual or like an interactive movie or visual novel kind of mechanic,
sure.
Improv. There's a lot of improv exercises that work this way.
Yeah.
Where the idea is that think of an improv person on a stage as a method in a program, and then the audience, whatever they give them, that's the argument that goes into the method, and then you get a result, right? And so it actually does have a kind of, I mean, that's a programming metaphor, but there's a lot of like sort of gameplay elements in the sense that like there's play with the audience, but also the results are dependent on the activity, right? Sometimes there are like improv competitions where you know, you actually keep track. It's like a game show format kind of. So mm-hmm. Whose Line Is It Anyway is a TV show that's based mm-hmm. it is just improv comedy. Mm-hmm. But it's the format where points are awarded, and it's all random and silly, but it's a gameplay framing. That's an improv format that exists in theaters all over the place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a way of like making it feel more like a game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that language of game stuff that sort of Ellen mm-hmm. is touching on with all these parts of this topic.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and I know I don't want to take up all of our time talking about this, and I don't want to wrap this topic up without bringing it back to game development. But to do that, just wanted, I guess, to say like we've listed a lot of examples. There are lots of things we didn't even talk about, like game shows.
Yeah.
But I think in listing all these and kind of talking about the different facets of what the experiences are like, what I think this is really comes back down to that games literacy piece that you're talking about, Mark. It's not just about like, yeah, we understand the idea of spinning a circle and getting something random,
mm-hmm.
like has been that kind of thing that's been on game shows for a while. But it's as we have more different types of games and those different types of mechanics become more widespread across different platforms and different consoles and so on and so forth, like the games literacy spreads and allows us to create more things that I think blend some of these different elements and these different mediums to make stuff that's really interesting. So I just kind of wanted to end on like, where do you see like how is this an opportunity for game developers? Like, how would we think about this as game developers to kind of like open up some of our, maybe open up some new doors for us creatively?
Yeah. I would think, to bring it back to my Star Trek example, sorry, Steven. this episode of Star Trek. If it's a successful story, right? Its goal was to tell this story about these people in this scenario. And it used the language of games and the understanding of games as a little mini, you know, like war games, literally, right? To successfully depict or communicate its message. And so if you find something like that for you, where you're watching a film or you're reading a book and there's gameplay elements, either as part of the fiction or as part of the structure of the story or something that you feel has done a good job, then think about that. And think about that when you're just making your own games. Yeah. Like the reason gameplay exists, not merely for its own sake. In the case of these films and pieces of fiction, they exist in those spaces to do the job of what that piece of work is doing, which is to tell the story, to communicate a message, to provide an emotional moment, to give you a reaction. Your game should do that too. And that doesn't mean that your game needs to have like heavy narrative elements or anything like that, the way that these other examples might. But that's, I think, what we can learn from this, is that as the sort of the value of and purpose of interactivity in service of whatever it is you need it to be in service of. And this is just my philosophy as a game developer, but that's always more than just it's a fun game. That could be the majority outcome of your experience. That could be what you're aiming for in a sense, but you're not even going to get that if you don't build something to elicit a feeling or tell a story or reveal a truth or ask a question. And so if you find yourself seeing a game in a piece of media that does that well, that's something to emulate and something to interrogate in your own work.
Yeah. And it's actually, I like that you brought that up, because like I think that the way games are depicted in other media, they oftentimes don't explain how the game works.
Right. They're not complete systems, right?
Yeah. And they don't need to be, right? Because the point of it is to help tell the story. And it's not so that you're designing a game in addition to making a new episode of a TV show or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Why would you do that to yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Please don't. So like you can, I mean, I hesitate to say this maybe, but like you can take some of that experience and think about it too, in that like if you're telling a story in your video game, you don't necessarily have to explain all of the details of specific systems in your game to tell that story. And by systems, I mean not like literally what the actions that the player can do, because like you should probably tell the player what they can do in your game.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But like I'm talking about like all of the underlying systems around the game. So like maybe some of the background of like what your characters are doing, or the location of the game, or maybe like the reasons as to why these mechanics exist or why you have to do these things. You don't necessarily have to explain all those things, as long as that narrative, that arc, the emotion is expressed to the player and they understand that innately somehow. You got to figure that out through playtesting. You can get the essence of that in your game.
Yeah. But also, Steven, you made me think, you really hit on something else too, which is the inverse of what I was talking about, which is you can make a game that has a really robust system and has a story, and the story is there to help elevate the gameplay systems. But you don't have to, I'll never know how to play Stratagema, because there's not enough information to give me a working system there. But that's okay, because that wasn't the point of that necessarily. But likewise, you can tell a story in your game and you don't have to tell the whole story. You can imply a story and use gameplay systems. It's a way to bring anything into anything else, right? It's what are you making, and what tools can you use to help you achieve the goal you're after.
Yeah, totally.
And my final addition to that is around Stratagema. Am I pronouncing that right?
Stratagema.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Kolrami would be very disappointed in you.
Well,
Grandmaster Kolrami.
It sounds like he would be, for lots of different reasons, frankly. But, you know, maybe not. Maybe someday you will. Because, like, that... one of the interesting things that I've noticed here is like games that or media that mention games or have games as a significant feature. It's now like because there are so many indie developers out there, they're also that's also a resource for authors and producers and other creators of other media to bring in, you know, experts to make something and fill it out. So if you think of like, okay, maybe if, anyway, if Bandersnatch maybe felt more like a game, it would have maybe been a little bit more successful. I don't know. But one example that is being teased is the Nine Kings game that I mentioned at the very beginning of this segment. Mm-hmm. So Brent Weeks, the author, has teased the idea that they're actually making Nine Kings, which was the game that he introduced just in the book. And yeah, so that'd be really, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. And I'm excited and it, to see what comes of that.
We talked about design pillars on the show in a previous topic, and we talk about it a lot generally. But when you have a game that comes from a piece of fiction, it comes prepackaged with a design pillar, which is which is the purpose it served in those fictional worlds. That is that can be kind of like it can be guiding, but it can also be restrictive. Super fascinating challenge. I mean, we talk about licensed games, same problem. Like, wow, lots to think about.
Yeah,
maybe that'll have to be the next some future version of a nice games jam.
Just make a fiction. Oh, that's a great idea. I love it.
Make Dabo.
Yeah. Human play Dom Jot.
Yeah. Yes, I understood that reference. Hey, you.
Me?
Me?
Yeah, you listening. You listening. You.
Oh, not us, Ellen.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No. The other ones. Y'all don't listen to me. It's the other people.
I'll carry on then.
Right. I've got some feedback. Give us feedback. That's the feedback. Give us more feedback through our feedback form.
Steven, let's say that I am you in this example. And I mean the you pointed at earlier. Not me who thought it was, or you, the person
so
I'm talking to. But the you you mentioned at the beginning of this when you said, hey, you.
I don't understand.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Can you grab me a graph?
So let's just imagine that, if you can. How might you, or me in this scenario, being the person you said hey you to earlier at the top of this, provide that feedback to you, who now I'm referring to is you, in fact, Steven.
Ah, yes, you, the listener, can provide you, the me, nicegames.club/feedback by using nicegames.club/feedback. Yep, that tracks, I think. Ellen, does that make sense?
Maybe I'll just email you.
Okay. No, use nicegames.club/feedback. Please give us feedback. We'd really appreciate it. We were talking about how we've been playing games together online through this pandemic, and I wanted to talk about online play as a topic because, I don't know, it's cool. Online play.
Something we do now. Something we do.
Yeah.
You're really selling me on this topic, Stephen.
I mean... We're all playing games online, and like people have been playing games online for years. So and it's something we haven't explicitly talked about, even though I released a game that you could play online.
I mean, as indies, it's not something we get to touch that much.
Online games are very difficult to make.
But you have the experience.
I do. I mean, I wasn't the person who like created the systems that does the online stuff, but like I managed it and I poked at it some to try to get some stuff to work. So like I have an idea. I could figure it out if like I got paid to do it again.
Yeah.
But not right now, not for like my future games. But yeah, I guess I want to talk about like the difference between like online play and offline play. And like what kinds of things as a developer you want to think about when you're making an online game. And so like when you're like the obvious difference between offline and online play is when you're playing with somebody in an offline situation, you're playing with them in person. So if they do something that you don't like, you have the ability to do something about it. You know, like, I don't know, punch them on the shoulder or something. Say, hey, stop that.
Yeah. Huh?
Or if you're not playing your brother.
Right.
Like... other things.
Yeah, or be kind. I don't know. Yeah.
Say something witty.
Yeah. So in order for people online to, people in an online game to interact with one another, they need to have some form of system to do so. You have to put that system in yourself, or they have to find an outside source. We've been playing our games online through Discord, but there are a lot of games that are online that have like voice chat or text chat, things like that. And so, yeah, like that I think though, I think other than like the actual framework to make an online game, which I'm not going to go into detail on here because like I don't fully understand it and it's very complicated. And like there are tutorials you could look at that are better, that would detail it better than I would in this moment. Yeah, I want to talk about like those kinds of things, those kinds of thoughts you want to consider when you're making an online game, because like I think they're important and they help you as the player create an online experience that other people would want to play and, you know, and participate in.
Yeah.
So I guess one thing like I wanted to ask y'all is like, what kinds of games do you think work best in an online environment, or things that like, what kind of games have been fun in an online environment for you?
Oh, that's tough.
We were talking
putting you on the spot.
I mean, we were talking about how we play Civ together on the weekends, and I was saying before we started recording how that doesn't feel like an online game to me because it feels more like a tabletop game, because we're all in voice chat and we're all making small talk or table talk. And even though the game itself wouldn't work as a board game. So maybe it's because I don't have a ton of experience with online games that I don't consider that an online experience as much, at least the way we play it.
Sure.
So I think that puts me at a disadvantage because I'm having like a really weird approach to what I even consider online play at all. So knowing what would be good or bad for it, because I don't know how enjoyable Civ would be if we weren't all talking with each other. You know,
yeah. I mean, I there's an argument to be made that the turn-based 4X gameplay of Civ leaves you enough downtime to, you know, to engage in other forms of another talk. Whereas another game, like if you were to play League of Legends, you don't really have enough, you don't have great opportunities to like involve that small talk thing like that. So I mean, there's an argument to be made that like turn-based online play provides you with an experience that allows you to, you know, just do small talk stuff like you would in a board game.
Yeah.
Well, the turn-based element does the turn-based element does make it feel a lot more like a board game, right? I'm trying to think of board game. I'm sure there are tabletop games where you're all maybe working simultaneously, but then like you are taking an action in a shared space on a turn-by-turn basis. And those do, I mean, that is what Civ feels like. Since the pandemic started, I played a lot more board, you know, tabletop games online, and it does feel very similar. You're pointing and clicking and you're panning around the board and you're rotating, looking at things in different ways, and you're pulling up side menus to reference things, and you've got the rules or your guides over on the right hand side document telling you like, this is what you should do with your sack of horse archers and so on and so forth. And that is Civ, and that's also a lot of the, if you're taking tabletop games, it feels exactly the same way if you're taking those tabletop games and you're playing them on like Tabletopia or something like that. So I think that what might feel more like an online game to you, Mark, at least the way that you're talking about it, is if there's this, if it's fully synchronous. And it's a different type of rules, right? There's different mechanics involved. Which of course is getting back to what Stephen was saying, why like you don't want to get into the technical aspects of it because it's so specific based on the game.
Yeah, I imagine.
That does seem like one of the first, you know, the first, if you're kind of thinking about this as like a map, a concept map of the different choices and dynamics you have to explore with different types of games, if you're putting them online, one of the first points of divergence you're going to get to is it synchronous or is it turn-based?
But although ironically, you've stumbled into what I might consider makes for a good online game, which is a board game like Civ, if that's how we're describing it, but is so complicated that you wouldn't want to manage with fiddly pieces, right? So think of a game like Star Trek Ascendancy, which we've played, which is a very fiddly 4X game, but is actually quite light compared to other 4X games, board games. But
dang, it is.
but if you describe Civ like a 4X board game, it would be absolutely insufferable for dozens of reasons. Yeah. And so it is suitable. Like that, like a 4X board game is suitable to be online, and it allows for more depth and complication, and it allows for some rule systems to be discarded because their existence is predicated on that that in-personness to it. But I think, Ellen, ultimately you are right, is that my feelings of it, you know, my first impression of it doesn't feel online. So I'm not sure how valid a feeling that is, but yeah, it's about synchronicity, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, yeah, on the other end of the spectrum, we're talking about, like, action games, MMOs, fighting games, things like that, where, like, you are competing against one another or competing against some AI in a server. And, I mean, I think that when people think of online games, I think you're right, Mark, like, people think of these kinds of games. And so,
synchronous,
like,
games.
Yeah, synchronous games, action-y games, things like that. Not turn-based.
Right.
But I mean, I think those are much more difficult to, in terms of coding, it's much more difficult to build these kinds of games versus turn-based ones, because, like, they are, I mean, you just, like, when somebody takes their turn, you do the thing, and then you send them that information. In an online environment, there's a bunch of things you got to consider, like, the latency of one competitor versus another competitor. Or if you did a thing and then somebody else does a thing and then it goes into the server, does that go at different times at the same time? How does the server handle that information and send it back to the players? Because the players need to get that information back too.
Yeah.
All those kinds of things. You gotta consider those kinds of things. And it makes the experience much more difficult to support.
Yeah.
But everybody's, you know, tons of people are playing MMOs. Tons of people are playing fighting games online, and stuff now. So there's an audience for it.
Well, it's interesting you use like an online shooter versus an MMO. The authentication of what happened this millisecond is important in a online shooter, and it's not important in an MMO.
That's true.
MMOs are kind of turn-based in the sense that you send commands and then the game resolves them whenever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, in terms of the gameplay, I mean, it is a real-time experience, but it's not critically real-time, right? So, like, a shooter will have something where if someone is moving, but there's a bit of a delay, if I'm their opponent, then I'm disadvantaged by that person's laggy internet because I'm going to shoot at where the computer last thinks they are, but they're actually a little bit ahead. So games account for that, technically, by predicting where players are going to move. And then once they find out where they actually did move, make little adjustments, if necessary, to try to compensate for those sorts of things. And so the technical hurdles are enormous. And it's interesting, like, to take a game that was not designed to be online and put it online, because then you have to account for all those things. Yep. But it is also interesting to think of a game that's designed to be online.
Yeah,
and designed to maybe avoid some of those troubles.
Yeah. One thing I will say when you're developing an online game is, if your plan is to develop an online game, you want to do that from jump, because it makes it a lot more difficult to implement these online systems out of after the fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has implications for everything.
Yeah.
Like your core mechanics.
Yes. Yeah, everything gets changed.
Yeah.
So Mark, you're totally right about that. But now I think we're getting into the technical stuff again, and it's too much. one thing I do want to talk about that, I mean, I guess you'd have to implement, and it's kind of technical, but whatever, is that, like, you have to consider how people communicate in the games. And not just, like, adding voice chat or adding text chat or things like that. You have to make sure that like everyone has the opportunity to play your game and feels comfortable in the environment. Because, like I said, the difference between an online play and an offline play is that in an offline environment, that person has their own agency. They are human in the meat space within this other person. So, like, they can theoretically do something if, like, you know, you're being rude or mean or unsportsmanlike or whatever. Whereas, like, in an online session, you don't that the responsibility of that is on the developer to put that functionality in.
They have the
agency to do something if, you know, things go south. Mm-hmm. So like, I think it's important to make sure your online game has, if it has some form of communication, then it should, you should make sure that like you can report users that are abusing that form of communication. Like, because I think that I think a lot of like most games, if they're online, have that kind of functionality. But I think there are a lot of times, even now, where games are coming out and they don't have that functionality, and then like people are just dead in the water if I don't know, somebody hacked your systems and stole all of your loot or whatever.
Or what I think is a problem is that games will try to resolve, like they'll allow you to voice chat is optional, or you can report certain users. Like there's things, systems in place, but ultimately they put the burden on the aggrieved party to do the actual management of the system to keep it robust. So this is very common with harassing women online, which is that, you know, there are tools with which to fight that harassment. But like, it seems really oppressive by nature to ask a player to also be in charge of that, you know?
Right. The player who's having the worst experience to have an additional, you know, task. Yeah.
Yeah. Easier just to disconnect.
Yeah. They're also responsible for leveraging those tools, for understanding those tools, for following up, for, you know, and that just seems difficult. And I think a lot of developers just look at the logic of it and they say, well, what could we possibly do? Have somebody keeping an eye on every match out there? And it's like, well, yes, that's impractical, but that would be a way to solve it. And I think it's very easy to say, well, it seems like it's, if we were to actually take this seriously, then it would be too hard a challenge. So we're just not going to take it seriously. And I think that's usually what happens.
Right.
I mean, also, they'll pour millions into anti-cheat methods, like, you know, but not into like robust moderation systems.
But also, like, you know, there's a server that is looking at literally everything anybody does.
Yeah.
So, like, they have the technology. I think that, like, some online games, like, do, like, have people whose job it is to just look at chat logs and see, oh, this person said the N-word or whatever, and they kick them. I agree, though, Mark, in that, like, there should be more things developed in the game to prevent that kind of stuff from happening in the first place.
Yeah.
And I mean, to be fair, I think it is a difficult problem to solve, because like this isn't something that we've solved in offline space.
That's true. That's true. Like, I guess the point I'm making is that it being a hard challenge, but it's also, it should be the bare minimum to operate these systems, to actually implement these things. It seems like weird that we approach it by, let's build a rickety building and then maybe we'll prop it up. It just seems like yes, it means you can't build that building until you figure out this problem. But because we're letting people, I'm just going to continue this metaphor, we're letting people build all these buildings that are not up to code, and then praying they realize that that's a bad experience for the building's occupants and that they spruce it up in the meantime. Like, it seems like what we should really be doing is just not letting people build buildings that are at risk of crumbling, and unless they figure, and then maybe the industry will figure it out. Like, I don't know. My metaphor is too deep to be actionable. Do you know what I mean? I have to be fair also. Because also, I mean, truth is there are people who are educating themselves on the need for these sorts of things, and it's a little bit their fault that they didn't know, but it's like a lot of people are learning these things for the first time in a system where we've been allowed to make these games without these systems, or without systems that are robust enough, for decades.
Yeah.
So I understand that it's not easy to undo that impression of how these things are put together, but it seems like we should not be accepting that this is even possible, you know?
Well, and that's why I want to bring it up, because I think that as the industry, we should be considering these things. Not start, because we've been doing it, but we need to.
Yeah, do more, there have been efforts for certain. People are trying. They are trying.
One way that like I applaud Riot Games, but I don't think they've done the best job of, is like they've been trying to incentivize positive actions in games instead of, you know, disincentivizing negative actions. That's had some success, but I don't know. It feels I don't know how much that helps, because League of Legends mm-hmm. still has a lot of people consider it to have not a toxic fan base, I guess.
Yeah.
Or community.
Well, it goes back to that really illustrates how it goes back to your game design. Are you building a game where players would be motivated to behave in this way or that way, rather than just accounting for it when it happens? And that's a psychology question. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose one way to go about this is to just prevent people from communicating between one another in the first place, right? If your game can sustain that.
Yeah.
Can you do? I mean, yes, and that actually, and I don't know if we want to spend too much time on communication, although it's really important.
Yeah.
But even if your game doesn't allow players to communicate, that doesn't necessarily mean that they won't find other ways to do it.
Right, yeah, like it's still abuse thing.
Griefing is a whole skill set, you know.
Yeah, it's a whole skill set.
as indie developers, we're like, oh man, netcode is hard, but it's the least mm-hmm. difficult part of the process, frankly.
Yeah.
Right. I think once we understand that, then maybe we can start looking for solutions. Which is, I mean, I'm making this into a real downer topic, but there have been people who've done a pretty good job at making interesting and really interesting ways to develop online systems that are innovative and also not offensive in the ways we've been upset by other games that can develop toxic communities.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing you need to consider when you're making your online game is how many people are available in your session. Because that adds up, it makes the games more complicated for the server to handle, and all that information has to get disseminated to all of the people within this instance of the game. Keep in mind, is your game going to have 4 people per session, 4 people or 10 people per session, 60 people, 300? Because that's a thing now. I think, I don't know. those kinds of things. And also like the mechanics behind that, you have to consider how all of these people are interacting with one another. Like if there's 300 people, can 299 of those people gang up on one person?
Is that possible?
That'd make for an interesting game.
And are those interactions interesting to those players, or is it just the gee whiz, we got 300 people on a server?
Yeah. You know? Sometimes that is the novelty of it, is the game just supports a ton of people, and that's what's interesting about it. And arguably there's a space for that kind of experimentation.
Yeah. There's a lot of room in that design space because there's not a lot of examples.
So you can
come up with lots of interesting ways to use 300 people. You can try. It's a challenge.
Yeah, for sure. But it is a challenge, to just even support that many people. So just that's something to consider. Monetization and servers, upkeep, those kinds of things, because it is, depending on how many people are playing your game at any given moment, it can be expensive to support all of those people. And so you either need to be made of money and just be able to throw money at the problem, or you need to find some method to earn money through the game so that you can support the system so that people keep playing it.
Right. And players are not going to understand your maintenance costs.
Yeah.
And so you're going to have to convince them it's worth that, they're getting your game. They have to pay to keep the servers up. Players don't understand that as a purchase. They don't understand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a communications issue, like a PR issue as well.
Right. Right. And I don't want to bring the forbidden topic into this conversation, but it's because servers are constant upkeep. You have to consider you got to make sure that either you're getting more new people to play the game and buy the game regularly, or consider, implementing content that people can pay for as the game goes on.
Yep. Or subscriptions, but that's not in vogue any longer. So.
Or subscriptions. I always forget subscriptions, I think.
That's because no one does it anymore.
It's not a
viable market strategy. It's just the one that's least ethically fraught. But we don't have to get into that again.
That'll be another topic for another episode.
Yeah, that's yep. So I guess one thing I wanted to bring up in terms of making an online game as an indie developer is there are some tools that make it easier. Unity has its own online play surface. So if you wanted to use that, you could do that. Mm-hmm. If you're using Unity.
And that's an API, but also a backend that you would pay Unity for.
Yeah, right? I think once you get to a certain point, there are a certain number of players, regular players, then yeah, you
have right. To it's close to free or free if you have a small demands.
Yeah, and I think most of these like online API things would be close to free if you're not planning on having a large audience at a regular time, while people are playing it. So with Treasure Stack, which was an online game, we used Photon. That worked for us because like we had some of the we had some online gameplay and some online functionality from previous games that we like kind of made it work for Treasure Stack.
Yeah.
Think about that for your game too. Just make sure. Mm-hmm. Just to consider all those different surfaces. I'm not familiar with the differences in the surfaces, but like
yeah, it is, they all seem to have some. Many of them seem to have some specific limitation that you go in knowing, right? So Unity's setup will work for any Unity game, but only for Unity games. Although now that I say that out loud, I think Unity might have announced its availability for anybody. But I don't quote me on that. Photon, I think, is truly cross-platform altogether, right?
Treasure Stack works on, like, you can play with anybody on Switch, Steam, and Xbox.
Yeah. Steam has its own service now. It's relatively new, I believe. And that covers a lot of people's developer audiences, because many of them don't intend to publish anywhere but Steam. And then all the console makers have their own systems that are actually quite accessible and have no cost, but they're extremely limited because they're only for those console players. And where we now live in a world where that's not players don't like that, but also if you're making a small indie game, it's hard to you don't want to segment your small audience. That makes it exponentially more difficult to grow your player base.
Definitely does. Mm-hmm. Know that firsthand. Are there any other design considerations that I didn't put in the notes that y'all want to bring up?
I think you did a good job of the big overview, which is like, because it's one of those topics that I think indie developers are like, I know it's tough, I know, but maybe one day I'll look into it. And this is a great, you've given them a great place to start.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of considerations involved, but just like with everything else, you want to make sure you think about it before you just implement it. You don't want to just put it in. You want to go through the motions and do the homework first before you decide to spend all of this time putting in online play, because it can add a year or at least a year to your development time, honestly.
A common reaction is to be scared off of it immediately, but look into it before you totally write it off. It is scary, and let's say you're probably not going to go that route, but like, know why you're not. Don't just be scared of it.
And it can open up the game to a whole new audience.
Yeah.
That would not be able to play it otherwise.
He could. I think one thing we didn't really dig into very deeply, which I think is worth mentioning.
Yeah.
Is just, you know, recognize that when you're putting something online, you are kind of amplifying some of the, I think maybe amplifying is the right word, amplifying some of the dynamics of the differences in play style that wouldn't necessarily happen if you're just playing around the couch. So if you're playing a cooperative or a competitive game on the couch, you know the people that you're with because they're in the same space as you. And so right now they're part of your household, hopefully. But in non-pandemic times, you know, like they're still in your home or you're in their home, so you know each other. Right. And even if you have drastically different play styles, like you might be able to navigate that, or you hope that you will be able to navigate like that. Yeah. That's what we're experiencing in Civ, right? Like, it's just not my jam. Mm-hmm. But I'm still having fun because I'm hanging out with my friends. Mm-hmm. If you're putting the game online and then allowing strangers to play with each other, those differences in play styles are going to be one of the first things they run into.
Yeah.
You want to think, that makes you have to think carefully about how you're going to manage that. Or whether you want to. Maybe you don't want to have this type of player in this type of game, in that case, how are you going to make sure you market it so that that's clear?
Yeah. Ellen, that's a really, really important insight. Because you think about, like, playing GoldenEye with your friends, and you all agree, slappers only or whatever. Whatever the rule set is. And then you develop that's becomes the what's enjoyable to you. Or Steven, when we're playing Civ together and I've just taken your second to last city.
Why did you put that in this?
It came up naturally.
Okay.
And I could easily go and take your capital. And if you were a stranger online, I'd have no compunction. But I don't want to put you out of a state house. So
yeah. Thank you. You're so generous, Mark.
Well, you gave me no other choice, so...
Yep.
I'm telling you, Steven, I think you started it.
What?
Oh, great. Well, now everybody thinks that.
Cool. Everyone who thinks... We can put it on Twitter. We'll make it a poll. Everyone who thinks Mark started it versus Steven? Anyway.
Well, Steven, if we did that, we would have to give everybody all the information, and I don't know if you want that.
It's not great on my side, regardless, really.
But that's an important thing. That's part of why it didn't feel like an online game, is because not just playing with friends, but like that is a big part of it. And it does. Ellen is really hit on that.
Yeah. It does. It changes the dynamic, so that's something to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Yeah, I like that. That's a good point.
All right, that's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to the resources on today's topics. If you liked this episode, give us a review in your favorite podcast app and tell your friends. Independent podcasts like ours rely on word of mouth to grow. We love hearing from our listeners. For a quick way to give us feedback on the show, head over to nicegames.club/feedback and fill out a short little form. You can also get in touch with your nice hosts on Twitter at nicegamesclub, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and staring into the abyss. It's more fun than it sounds. I should read these ahead of time.
Staring into the abyss.
You can also email us, contact@nicegames.club. Ask us questions, suggest topics, or just say hello. So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. I was a little worried about that when I was reading. I'm like, we're being really aggro here. And then my brain disconnected from itself when Mark started talking.
That's a common side effect of me
talking.
And
it came back together at the end.
Oh, that was wonderful.
Now we're all dancing. Except for Mark's not dancing. Mark?
What?
Okay.
I'm a square. Yeah. I'm not allowed to dance.
Yeah. Fine. All right. He's the guy in the corner.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.